My name is Stanley Laham. I am from Florida. I studied at the University of Florida, obtained my doctorate degree in the Department of Immunology and Molecular Genetics of the School of Medicine in 1978. I have done postdocs working with rhabdovirus, which is the virus of rabies, and in the process discovered a new retrovirus. Well, I'm retired.
So could you tell us how you can compare the workings of the various different types of vaccines that are now on offer?
Of course. First, here in the United States, what's being heralded now are the Moderna vaccine and the Pfizer vaccine. Both of them are mRNA vaccines. To explain what that means, and this is new, it has never been done before. They've extracted the portion from the coronavirus in its RNA that codes for the spike protein on the envelope, to which, if you make antibodies, you will neutralize the virus. They have taken this piece of mRNA. They have put nanolipid particles around it to make it a little bit more stable. And that, in essence, is a vaccine. As far as exactly how they do it, it's their proprietary secret. They haven't said that. They haven't published that. They claim that it's 90 to 95% effective in evoking neutralizing antibodies to the coronavirus. Now, there are problems with it due to the fact that it went on fast track. It was not tested in animals. And I have previously described some of the dangers of this, because you have mRNA being injected into a subject. It may penetrate any cell. It's not targeted to any cells. And the idea is that your cells are going to pick up this mRNA. It's going to migrate to your ribosome, the intracellular ribosomes of the cells, where it will be translated into the spike protein. This spike protein will now migrate to the cellular membrane, where your immune system will recognize it as foreign. B lymphocytes will make antibodies to it, and T lymphocytes, killer T cells, will attack the cell itself as a foreign entity. Now, as the danger with that is that it may create autoimmune diseases. In normal development of vaccine, they would have tried that on animals first. Then after they see that it produced, that the animal becomes immune to the virus in question, they would euthanize some of the animals, examine its organs, see which cells picked up this mRNA and which presented that mRNA on its surface in order to stimulate the immune system. Now, this part, which would take a couple of years, was skipped. So, as far as an mRNA vaccine is concerned, it would be sort of problematic because no one has done it before, and it's not possible to tell what the long-term effects are. Now, this is in the United States. In the United Kingdom, you have the AstraZeneca Oxford vaccine. And you also have in Russia the Sputnik V as a vaccine. Now, here's the big difference between the two of them. What the Russians have done, they have taken that mRNA that's being injected directly into people here in the United States. They put it in a human adenovirus. They reverse transcriptase that RNA into DNA, because adenoviruses are DNA viruses, inserted it into the adenovirus serotype 5 and serotype 26, and use that as a vaccine, so that this adenovirus, which is a DNA virus, will produce the protein, the coronavirus protein, and your immune system will develop antibodies and cellular immunity to it. The AstraZeneca Oxford vaccine is somewhat similar to the Russian vaccine, except that they're not using human adenovirus. They're using a simian adenovirus, a monkey adenovirus, in which they've inserted the spike protein. Now, this adenovirus is not supposed to replicate. It's been genetically, one could say, castrated for it not to replicate, but present the corona spike antigen. The difference between the Russian and the British vaccine is that the Russians are using human adenoviruses, which pose less risk of an anaphylactic reaction. As you know, with the AstraZeneca Oxford vaccine, the first two, I think, nurses that took it developed anaphylactic type reactions to it.
So what is that?
It's a strong allergic immune response that we call anaphylaxis, where all kinds of cytokines and histamines are released. Your body can go into shock, and you can die from it. Now, these ladies, it seems, had on hand anti-allergic pens containing measured dose of adrenaline or epinephrine, which is which stops the anaphylactic reaction. Another difference is that the AstraZeneca vaccine seems to be about 70% effective. The Russian vaccine seems to be 95% effective. And from what I gathered, both in the United Kingdom and in Canada, because I do have somebody in the, a doctor, a physician, who's getting the AstraZeneca vaccine, the booster shot that AstraZeneca will start giving will be the Sputnik V. And that's where we're at right now.
The actual COVID-19, the SARS-CoV-2, is really the most recent version of the SARS-CoV-1. I mean, was there any work done on that which has been able to inform the various pharmaceutical companies and doctors into preparing a vaccine for SARS-CoV-2, which arrived on the scene about 15 years later?
Yes. And that's why the Gamaleya Institute in Russia was that far ahead, because of their work on the SARS, original SARS Corona 1. And also some antivirals were tried. And I think it's informative to know that remdesivir, which is the recommended antiviral in the United States by Dr. Anthony Fauci, who is the current expert, did not work for SARS-CoV-1. It was tried. Whereas simple drugs like chloroquine had much better effect.
Well, this is a bit of a mystery, isn't it? We can see tests with these two drugs, particularly chloroquine and ivermectin, seem to have a big effect, particularly at the early stages of people catching, well, actually, it's catching many different viruses, but particularly with SARS-CoV-2, with COVID-19, it seems to have quite a powerful effect, which is obviously going to be pretty useful for anybody catching it to dampen the initial spread of the virus in the body, to slow it all down. It gives the body a much better chance of identifying and training the immune system to actually fight the virus if it's being given what you might describe a kick in the teeth as it first arrives in the body from chloroquine or ivermectin. So what's your view about how effective these drugs are, and if you think they are, why they're not being used much?
As far as chloroquine and ivermectin, both studies, in vitro studies, were published in Nature and Cell Biology. The study on ivermectin showed that cell cultures in which you were growing the coronavirus, because you grow viruses on cell cultures, it's not like bacteria where you can grow them on agar or something like that. They need cells to replicate. They are obligate intracellular, actually just a genetic code.
Okay, so what is that cell culture? Where does it come from?
No, many cell cultures exist. There are many cell cultures that are available, commercially, that have been established, from kidney cell cultures, nasopharyngeal cell cultures, ciliated cell cultures. There are many HeLa cell cultures that are commercially available.
Okay, so those are human cells, are they?
Yes, some are human cells, some are not non-human cells. Some were derived from embryonic cells, embryonic human cells. Some were derived from kidney cells. The important thing is to have a cell culture in which the virus thrives, replicates. Once you have that, you can test what inhibits this replication. With ivermectin, after infecting about 100 cell cultures, 50 of them having in the nutritive fluid in the cell culture, adding ivermectin, the virus did not replicate, whereas in the control, the virus replicated completely. On top of that, in cells where the virus was already replicating, by adding ivermectin, I can't remember exactly how many micromolar per milliliter in the supernatant fluid, after 48 hours, all viral RNA became undetectable. There were no longer viral RNA detectable in these tissue cultures. So it's not just a small effect. It's a dramatic effect. Now, as far as why it's not being... Oh, let me add. In countries like Honduras, El Salvador, and even in India now, they're giving ivermectin preventively as prophylaxis, not to catch the COVID-19 virus. In other words, to... if you do come in contact with people, as soon as, it knocks it out, as soon as you breathe it in, as soon as it infects the first cells in your respiratory tract. Now, as far as why it's not being used, and why remdesivir is being used, I'm convinced that it has to do with economics, because Gilead Pharmaceuticals that makes remdesivir, and their patent on it is close to expiring. I think, and treatment with remdesivir in hospital here costs $10,000, and they've given an excuse that it's cost the cost is less than 3 days in the hospital, because all studies showed that treating people with remdesivir, the greatest effect they had on the people that it had an effect, it reduced by 3 days their stay in the hospital. If they were going to spend 20 days, they spent 17 days. That's what they did. That's the experiment they did with remdesivir on a large scale on hospital patients. That on average, patients that were on remdesivir spent 3 days less than those that were not on remdesivir. That does not count the deaths of people who were or were not on remdesivir, and I have a cousin who just died in hospital, even though he was being given high doses of remdesivir.
So is there any evidence that remdesivir actually lessens the likelihood of death?
Not really that I know of. Those who remain less in the hospital because of it, we do not know whether they were going to die or not.
Okay, so it gives a kind of, at least the most we know is that it gives you, if you're going to survive, your recovery may be a bit quicker.
Yes, but even that study is a bit suspicious. It is a fact that the place where it's being used the most is the United States, and it is also a fact that the most deaths per 100,000 is in the United States. So you can make the correlation.
Okay, so we're hearing that ivermectin is being used over in Central America and in India. Why not in the UK and in the United States, especially since the results seem much clearer that it is a lifesaver potentially?
I do believe it is, and it's a mystery to me. I don't know. I don't know if it's big pharma. Obviously, there are two things concerning chloroquine and ivermectin, is that there are no patents on them. They're very cheap. So there's no big fortune to be made by any pharmaceutical company on them. Whereas on a new drug that is patented, then, the sky is the limit as far as making money on it.
Okay, so what about the usual use for these two drugs? Because, obviously they were not designed to be used for COVID-19.
No, they were not. chloroquine has been in use for about 70 years. It has saved millions of lives from people suffering from malaria. It is standard treatment for malaria, the scourge of the lands of the South. Malaria was a much bigger killer than COVID-19, needless to say. Tens of millions of people have taken chloroquine, and it has saved the lives of millions. And it was placed on the United Nations, the World Health Organization's list of essential drugs for humanity. You can check that out. Throughout those time, we never heard about any warning of nefarious cardiac effect. But now, all of a sudden, when it's being used for COVID-19, we hear that it may cause, ventricular fibrillation or other rhythmic irregularities with the heart, which is strange because we never had those warnings before. Now, I also have to tell you that chloroquine has been used for 70 years almost for malaria, and in the last 20 years, it has become standard treatment for people with systemic lupus erythematosus and rheumatoid arthritis, because on top of being an anti-malarial drug, they found out that it was a good immune modulator. People with rheumatoid arthritis and with systemic lupus erythematosus, these are two autoimmune diseases. And it was found that chloroquine modulates the immune response like prednisone used to do for people with systemic lupus erythematosus would be on prednisone for life, being a steroid. I suppose you and your listeners are aware that steroids like cortisones are immune suppressants. Well, chloroquine seems to do the same thing. Now, one reason why it would be helpful in COVID-19 is that COVID-19 seems to cause, at the terminal stage, what they call a cytokine storm, which is an uncontrolled immune response, release of cytokines that can cause many blood clots in the in many capillaries and small arteries and in the alveoli of the lung. Hence, they put people on respirators, and as you know, putting people on respirators, it's a 50-50 chance whether they come out of it or not.
So are the respirators actually what is required at that stage, do you think, or maybe some different type of treatment?
Well, I would think that at that stage, steroids would be very effective, perhaps some oxygen to help augment the partial pressure, you know, the PPO, you know, in our hemoglobin to help us survive. But the real treatment would be steroids to attenuate the cytokine storm. But let's get back to now ivermectin. Ivermectin itself was elaborated by a Japanese fellow back in 1975. And it's also an excellent anti-parasit drug for things like amoeba, whether it's Entamoeba histolytica or Wardia lamblii, it's excellent. It's an excellent anti-parasitic drug. But it was found also that it may have some anti-cancer effects before COVID-19 and antiviral effects before COVID-19. Now, when it was tested on COVID-19, it showed what I think is dramatic results. As far as why they are not being used, on chloroquine, they tagged heart, warning on it. On ivermectin, they haven't tagged anything yet on it. So why it's not in use either in the United States or the United Kingdom or everywhere, for that matter, I don't know. This is something to ask the Ministry of Health in the United Kingdom, the WHO, and I suppose here the CDC and NIH.
What about the political pressure on these organizations? Because we keep hearing that the big pharmaceutical lobby is as powerful, if not even more powerful in some countries than even the arms lobby. So they're obviously trying to make sure that these regulators come up with the decisions which are going to be good for profits.
Most definitely. In the United Kingdom, I suppose you could tell me how it is, but I can tell you how it is here in the United States. Since the Reagan administration, it's a revolving door between the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, that gives its approval for drugs, and Big Pharma. You get people directly from Big Pharma being appointed head of the Food and Drug Administration, and when a different administration comes and they appoint another one from Big Pharma, they go back to Big Pharma. The same thing that you have with the military-industrial complex. Generals, as soon as, for example, here's our new Minister of the Secretary of Defense, which you would call Minister of Defense in the United Kingdom, are appointed Secretary of Defense, comes directly, you know, from Raytheon. Yeah, he was in the Pentagon. He retired 2 years ago. He's working now for the arms industry, and now he's being appointed, notice illegally, but they're going to make an exception for him because you're supposed to be at least 7 years out of the Pentagon before you can become Secretary of Defense. But he's been out only 2 years. In the meantime, he was on the board of one of the biggest missile manufacturers, cruise missile manufacturers, and he's going to be Secretary of Defense. So you see, that type of revolving door, even Mark Esper, whom Trump just fired, came directly from the weapons industry to become Secretary of Defense.
Well, what's the problem with that? Because these people would argue, and many people would argue, that they are the experts.
No, they're the experts in making profits. They're not the experts in being Secretary of Defense. It's just like the same, let's get back to the argument in health. Are the people from the pharmaceutical companies who most of the time cover up mistakes in order to have drugs approved the best people to put in the FDA to approve or disapprove of drugs? It's the old tale of putting the fox in charge of the chicken coop.
Okay, so have you got any evidence that they cover up mistakes? Because surely that's not an easy thing to do. These tests have got to be properly done by the regulators.
Wait. Cover up mistakes in what? Are you talking specifically about COVID-19 or
about the drugs. You know, so a drug company...
About drugs in general?
Yeah.
Well, there are multiple examples and multiple documentaries that have been done on that, and the pharmaceutical companies pay an average of $6 billion a year in fines and lawsuits. That alone should tell you that something is wrong. Anybody listening can do a little search and see how much they pay in fines and in lawsuits. And whether with the, now with what they call the opioid crisis that we have, they knew very well what was going on.
Is it just a cost of doing business?
What do you mean by the cost?
Well, do these pharmaceutical companies set aside money and say, well, we know that you know, some people will die or there'll be some problem, and so we need to set aside some money, however many billions, to pay them off. But the profit we make by getting approval makes it worthwhile.
Yes, there's no doubt about that. There is absolutely no doubt about that. That it's the cost of doing business. But see, you remind me of an old American saying. I don't know if it's the same in the UK. You're talking about the cost of doing business. Well, there's an old saying here that corruption is the driving force of progress. Perhaps without corruption, you wouldn't have progress.
Okay, so if you were in charge of the policy there over COVID, because it does seem to be dragging on a very, very, very long time, much longer than most pandemics, and some people say it hasn't even reached the threshold of a pandemic, what would you do?
Well, for one thing, I would approve every one of the drugs that showed antiviral properties. Chloroquine and remdesivir, and it's the treatment, by the way, for patients in other countries. I'm saying chloroquine and ivermectin, something like remdesivir, which is an adenine analog, but a very poor adenine analog. So it doesn't work very well. Its affinity for the polymerase of the coronavirus is very small. That's why it doesn't work very well. But ivermectin and chloroquine, I would approve immediately. And the treatment with those two antivirals, accompanied by either azithromycin or doxycycline, has proven very effective in treating COVID-19. And that's why other countries have had, you know, a fraction of the fatalities of the United States, which is supposed to have the most exceptional and the best medical system in the world, health for profit in the United States, which it's, I think COVID-19 is showing the world that this health for profit that exists in the United States is totally inadequate.
Can you just tell us something also about the difference? We started talking about the different vaccines as to the Russian vaccine and the AstraZeneca vaccine, which cells, because you already said that the mRNA, the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines, well, we're not sure which cells they will go into any cell, which cells the more conventional types of vaccine, which cells they will go into.
A more conventional type of vaccine using a viral vector, an adeno vector, cells that will pick it up will be cells that have receptors for the attachment site of the adenovirus. So you have a natural limit on which cells and how many cells will pick it up. Circulating mRNA in the body, and I would love to ask that question to the chief scientist of Moderna and Pfizer, is that can you assure us which cells are going to pick up this mRNA and start making viral antigen? Is it any cells? Did you put something in the coding that targets cells? Like I told you, they're using nanoparticles, nanolipid particles, as a coating around the RNA. And notice they have to be kept at very low temperature. Have you ever wondered why one has to be kept at minus 70 degrees and the other one minus 25 degrees? It's because RNA is very unstable. And it tells you about the purity of the vaccine itself. They're afraid that any enzyme that accidentally gets into their preparation will denature that RNA. So in order to keep all biological activities at zeros, you need to keep it very cold. And there is, once it's denatured, if it gets to room temperature, it will denature and will be, you know, and will be useless. So the question is, you know, why use an mRNA vaccine? First of all, it's quicker. That's why for a fast track. Imagine you have to go an extra step. Once you've isolated that mRNA to make a traditional vaccine using an adenovector, you have to reverse transcriptase into the DNA of the adenovirus, make that adenovirus produce the corona antigen, and then use it as a vaccine. Whereas the mRNA, you just take the mRNA and you skip the other steps and you use it as a vaccine. So the big question is, that I would love to ask the chief scientific officers of both companies is exactly what cells, you know, can you assure us which cells are going to pick up that mRNA? If there was animal testing before, which takes, as I said, a couple of years, you can take organs from these animals that have been immunized after a year or 2 years, see where your mRNA has gone and which cells have produced that antigen. But as far as I know, these studies have not been done. They have skipped animal trials.
We aren't necessarily sure what's going to happen in 2 or 3 years' time down the line. with these mRNA vaccines. What is your general assessment of the whole idea of an mRNA vaccine? Do you think it's a step forward?
If there was enough time to study it, we could tell whether it's a step forward or a mistake. But we don't have the time, so it's hard to say now, but I can tell you what may happen. First of all, by many cells picking it up, any cells, and presenting the antigen, you're increasing the chances of autoimmune diseases, which you get with other vaccines also, but at a very low rate. In other words, the benefits outweigh the risks. I don't know if it's the same with the mRNA. Second, there's another enzyme in your cells called reverse transcriptase, which may very well incorporate this RNA, this mRNA, into your DNA. And it becomes, part of the cell's DNA by reverse transcriptase. And that's why it's important to know which cells are going to pick it up and what the long-term effect is going to be.
Some people have said that this is actually human genetic engineering. Do you think that's fair to say or not? Because if it is, it's surely the first time this has ever been approved.
No, I wouldn't say that it's human engineering, but human genetic engineering. But I will say that the possibility that it alters the genome is real. But it's a possibility. But we won't know unless we did, we had animal studies and models of it to know exactly what happens with an mRNA vaccine.
I mean, have mRNA vaccines been tried on animals, and have they been successful or not?
As far as I know, for the COVID-19, no, it hasn't been tried. This is the whole idea of the fast track, to skip the animal trials, and to skip some of the what was considered necessary before you approve a vaccine. I mean, that's the very definition of fast track.
Well, if someone is going to be damaged by a vaccine, maybe an mRNA vaccine, what would be the first sign that maybe something's going wrong?
It would be very hard for me to answer that question, but the first thing that one would look for signs of some autoimmune diseases in the person, onset of autoimmune diseases such as myasthenia or lupus or rheumatoid arthritis, things of that nature. That would be one of the first, one of the effects that I would very much fear.
Okay, so what are the symptoms of those things?
They're varied. It's impossible to predict all of them. From fever to joint pain to organ failure. It goes the whole. It can run the whole gamut of symptoms.
But basically, the idea is that
from thyroid damage, from thyroid damage to, I don't know if you're aware of that, but rheumatic heart fever is an autoimmune disease. So from the thyroid can be affected, the heart can be affected, but it's impossible to predict.
What about on the?
We don't know which cells are going to pick up that mRNA.
Well, what about on the more positive side? Some people, certainly friends of mine, are saying, well, actually, we aren't really worried because we're quite young about catching COVID-19 at all, or spreading it to our younger friends. And they have decided that they're just going to do things like take vitamin C, vitamin D, zinc, omega fish oil, things like that. Now, you might say that from the government's point of view, trying to restrict contact and talking about really the vaccine as the solution. How do you view people with that approach?
It's for COVID-19, where the mortality rate is very low. For healthy people who want to preventively take things like zinc, vitamin D, and I would include things like chloroquine once a week as a preventive, or ivermectin once a week. 500 milligrams of chloroquine once a week, or 12 milligrams of ivermectin once a week, you know, would be a great way to avoid getting the COVID-19, not to avoid getting the COVID-19, but to, in case you become exposed to it, you don't get sick from it.
And what do you make of the claims about people who have no symptoms being infectious and infecting other people around them?
Well, the most famous case of a symptomatic person infecting a lot of people, I'm sure you know the story of Typhoid Mary. She was carrying the typhoid bacteria. It had no effect on her, but she was propagating it to many people. With a respiratory virus, in order to make sure you're not, you can be asymptomatic. To know that you had it as asymptomatically, there's only one way to know it. You have to do a blood test for precipitating neutralizing antibodies. If you have precipitating neutralizing antibodies, that means you already had it, you got over it, and you had it with very mild symptoms that one would consider asymptomatic. Now, with most respiratory viral diseases, you are infectious before symptoms occur, usually 24 hours before you know you have it. And that's true with a common cold, with the flu, and all of them. So asymptomatically, you could transmit a virus.
And what about,
like I said,
is it possible to catch it twice? We keep hearing this, people can catch COVID once, twice or three, you know, maybe even multiple times, because that kind of goes against our instincts. Most of us, if we've had a flu in the one flu season, we don't then go and get the same flu again.
Yes, well, that I think is a lot of that is a bit of scaremongering, because if you have it, it has been shown that you retain memory cell for about 6 months. It would be if you could come in, you know, in contact with it again, but then you would have what they call a secondary immune response. And that's what it's all about. When you get vaccinated, you get a primary immune response. That doesn't mean, even if you get the vaccine, that you're not going to catch the COVID-19. You are going to get the COVID-19, but then you're going to have a secondary response. And you're protected, because you're immediately, what would take 4 to 5 days will take 12 hours to 24 hours in the secondary response. You eliminate the virus before it has time to spread. Well, the same thing for people who had COVID once. When they get it twice, if you get it, you know, a second time, then you get a secondary response. The first time you got it is as if you were vaccinated. The vaccine will not do more than the people who caught it once. I'll give you a simple example. I have a good friend of mine. She's 70 years old. And she tested positive and had symptoms, called me on the phone, was very congested, got her on a regimen of ivermectin, doxycycline, zinc, vitamin D, and high doses of vitamin C. Within 2 weeks, she was, completely well. After 3 weeks, she went to do the test, and she told me, I'm negative. The PCR test shows that I'm negative. She did it twice. Does that mean I don't have to take any vaccine, that I'm immune to it? I said, well, let's make sure of that. Let's make sure, because the PCR test, which she tested positive to begin with, has a nasty habit, about 10% false positive. I told her, let's make sure that that's exactly what you had. So I sent her to have a blood test for neutralizing antibodies, and she tested positive. I told her, now you're assured. Since you do have the antibodies, you do have the neutralizing antibodies, now you're sure you had the COVID-19, that it wasn't a false positive, a vaccine.
So that is what you're saying is you don't need the vaccine in that case.
Absolutely not. Nobody's going to, they would be turning immunology upside down to tell me that if you actually had the actual coronavirus, you got over it, you have neutralizing antibodies, that you would need the vaccine also. That would be a stupidity.
Where do you think the vaccine should be going?
Well, I think the vaccine should be... I would hope that if we're going to be vaccinated, that it goes to the most urgent people, which would be the older people, 65 or older, who are at greater risk of developing a grave reaction to the COVID-19, and then gradually go down. And of course, health workers who are taking care of patients, we want them available, so they should be among the first to get the vaccines. What I'm hoping is that more traditional vaccines are used rather than the mRNA vaccine. And in the United States, you have Johnson & Johnson that's supposed to come out with a similar human modified adenovirus as a vaccine. I think they're in phase 3 of their trials, and that would be, to me, let me put it this way. It would have much less unknowns than an mRNA vaccine.
And what about, what would you have to say to those doctors and patients who, although they think that something like ivermectin or chloroquine should be prescribed, that doctors are actually a bit nervous about prescribing it?
Actually, we have examples here of doctors who were told not to prescribe it, and pharmacies that refuse to fill the prescription.
Really?
I have three examples of that. Yes, absolutely.
Why is that?
I don't know why. I don't know. I really don't know. For example, if I, had COVID-19 with symptoms, I would tell my doctor to prescribe to me ivermectin, but not for COVID-19. Tell them that you have entamoeba or guardia or something like this. Because it seems that there is a reticence to use ivermectin for COVID-19. I don't know why.
Well, this is extraordinary, isn't it? Something which, lab tests have shown it does prohibit. In fact, it's a very safe drug, even and cheap.
Not only lab tests. Yeah, lab tests and in vivo, in people tests in many countries around the world.
And your own patients.
I have seen it work quite a few times. I have to say that there is a reaction to this pandemic, which is extraordinary, because I think I've pointed out to many people that we're facing a much more dire situation in 1981, 82, when the AIDS epidemic came out. As a matter of fact, we've had close to 40 million deaths, it seems, up to now, caused by immune deficiency caused by HIV. We still don't have a vaccine for it. But back then, when it first started, when the syndrome was first recognized as an immune deficiency syndrome, acquired immune deficiency syndrome, which is what AIDS stands for, at first it was dismissed because mostly homosexuals were getting it. Then after that, heroin addicts. But society still did not give it that much importance, since these are fringe groups. They were considered back then, fringe groups. And evangelists were even saying, well, that's God's punishment, whatever. But then when a certain group, the hemophiliacs, started getting it around the world, we saw that it was something that had been introduced into the blood supply of the world. Anybody getting a blood transfusion was in danger. And the first person I saw with AIDS was the mother of a friend of mine in Port-au-Prince, Haiti. And she was 82 years old. At age 80, she had a hip replacement surgery, blood transfusion, and she died of AIDS in 82. In 1982. So here we were facing a situation where blood transfusion, which is something that is used all over the world, in hospitals all over the world, in all types of operation, we knew the blood was dangerous. We knew we had to screen it for something, but we didn't know what that something was. So I think that was and the mortality was not 1%, 2%, or 10%, or 20%. It was 100%. In blood transfusion. That was a very dire situation, yet we did not see the panic that we're seeing now with COVID-19. I don't know.
Isn't it something like 0.5% mortality?
Pardon?
What's the mortality of COVID?
COVID? Well, it's less than 1% in general, yes. But depending on age groups, on older age groups, you know, if you're separating people by age groups, when you get to, retirement homes and things like this, it's a higher percentage of death rates. But of mortality, the mortality is higher. But in COVID-19, in general, if you're taking the population in general, the morbidity is low as well as the mortality. Morbidity meaning the number of people who get it and who get sick and need medical attention. Notice when they're saying we have, today, extraordinary 14,000 new cases today, 50,000 new cases today. What they're calling cases are positive tests. Usually the term case is described as an indication of sickness. But in COVID-19, it's not. It's simply being used. And when they say, you know, to me, it's the wrong thing to say that we have 30,000 new cases today. No, you have 30,000 people who tested positive today. Same thing for AIDS. But they don't make that mistake. They say this people, there are people who are HIV positive, but they don't have AIDS. The most famous example was Magic Johnson, who came out on television back in the day and said, well, I have AIDS. Well, he didn't have AIDS. He was HIV positive.
Stanley, where can people follow your work online? Can they? Where's the best place to find you?
Well, the best place to find me would be on ResearchGate sometimes on Facebook.
Are there any good, really reliable medical journals that we can go to keep track of some of the disinformation that we're getting in during this pandemic from the pharmaceutical companies?
Yeah, for example, if you look up the studies that have came out in Cell Biology on ivermectin and chloroquine, do the search on, you know, in the journal Nature, you'll find excellent information on these two antiviral drugs that are being used now in many parts of the world as an antiviral. The information is there. It's a question of looking for it.
Yeah, because the journalists don't seem to really be asking any awkward questions at all of the politicians, which I find quite shocking. Anyway, Dr. Stanley Laham, thanks very much for joining us.